couple of things have been going on in Syria this week. Have you noticed? So, it's kind of amazing that we can sit by while 100,000 people get killed, and then when 1,400 get killed, I mean, I understand it's chemical weapons and all that, but still, like I said before, I think we should have done something year before last, you know. Now it's like we're going to wait until Congress gives us the go-ahead. Well, I'm sure they'll get to that after they decide if the government's going to shut down because of funding or not. And that'll be up, and I don't know. So pretty soon, Assad will continue to just move on. So he'll continue on with what he's been doing. Okay, from last week, and we're going to be this lesson this week, and we're going to finish up next week. So if like I say, it only took a couple more weeks than what I was expecting, so that's all right. We will finish up on the history of Israel and the three faiths next week. September 4th is Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the Jewish New Year. The year will be 5774. And for those of you that don't know, the Jews have measured their calendar from the beginning of creation. So 5,774 years, and they qualify that with, because if they go back through all the generations discussed in the Bible, ages, everything like that, they come up with 5774. But they qualify that with, number one, we can't verify that all the generations are listed, and number two, we can't verify that it was seven actual days of creation. I think it was seven actual days of creation, but anyway, so they will qualify that, but that's where 5774 comes from, and it will be their new year this September the 4th. Just to let you know that things are still going on just like they have for many, many years. All right, so last week we looked at this ingathering that seems to be going on now, and we looked at the verses that spoke about a second ingathering, that God says, I will reach out my hand again a second time and gather all my people from the four quarters of the earth. Number one, we know that the first captivity where the Jews were ingathered was Babylon. We also saw that the first captivity actually happened in about 725 BC with the Assyrians taking the northern tribes captive. But then they kind of, what they call lost, the 10 lost tribes of Israel, we'll see that they weren't so lost after all. They kind of disappeared, and so people refer to those as the 10 lost tribes. So they were never ingathered that first time. It was with the Babylonian captivity where the Jews returned 70 years later. That was the first ingathering. Then in 70 AD, with the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, we saw a dispersion of the Jewish people throughout the world at that time. And so when is that second ingathering? Because God says in Amos, when I bring them back a second time, they will never again be uprooted from this land I have given them. So when is that second ingathering? I tend to think that we have been seeing it for the last few decades. Nothing else to me can explain the Jewish people scattered all over the world, retaining their language, their culture, and their religious traditions, wanting to go back to the land of their forefathers, and doing that in just within a few decades. I cannot explain that apart from the biblical prophecies. I just can't do it. 1964, Milestones was published by Said Qutb in Egypt. He is that was the Mein Kampf of the Muslim Brotherhood. And so we see that the Muslim Brotherhood speaks over and over about Islam becoming superior in all the countries where Islam touches and taking over the rule and into Sharia law. That's the Muslim Brotherhood's mission. And I showed you a few articles out of the Hamas and the PLO charters and constitution talking about that Israel should not exist and they will not put down their arms until one square inch of territory is not in any hand any longer. They don't want part of this land, they want it all. Then in the Six-Day War we talked about, that was June of 1967, Israel being outnumbered again. The Arab nations attacked Israel. They started amassing their troops on the border. Israel did a preemptive strike and within a few hours obliterated the Egyptian Air Force. And then from that point, they had superiority in all cases. And they finally called their own troops back from the edge of Cairo and Damascus before they took that. And they took the Sinai Peninsula, the Golan Heights, and several other things. And just to let you see, after the War of Independence, the border lines, the armistice lines, it was not a peace treaty, so it was just a ceasefire line. The armistice lines were as you see here. So from 49 to 67, we had the West Bank controlled by Jordan. We had the Gaza Strip controlled by Egypt. And then the Israelis took more territory after that independence war than what was divided with the United Nations. Remember, the United Nations partitioned it. The Israelis accepted it. The Arabs did not. And so after that war, the Israelis took more territory. Jerusalem was a divided capital. East Jerusalem run by the Jordanians. West Jerusalem by the Israelis. So then after 1967, after the Arab nations attacked and Israel fought again, they took even more territory. And see, you get the kind of a flavor going on here. Arab nations attack. They want all of the territory. They get beat. Israel takes more territory. The Arab nations say, but now we want it back. That, you know, I'm sorry, you lost the war. Okay, so after 1967, Israel controls the Sinai Peninsula, and they give that back in 1978. They control the Golan Heights, the border with Syria up at the northeast corner. They control a border strip of Lebanon until 2000. We're going to see that today. And they control the West Bank and Gaza Strip. So Israel has basically taken all this territory. After the Six-Day War, immediately after, they offered all this territory back if the Arab nations would recognize the state of Israel and sign a peace treaty with them. The Arab nations issued the three no's of Khartoum, Sudan. No peace, no negotiations, and no recognition. So they turned it down. And you're going, so then who's the righteous owner of this land? All right. Today, we're going to kind of fly on through here. In 1973, guess what? The Arab nations of Egypt and Syria tried again. On Yom Kippur, Israel's Day of Atonement, one of the holiest days of the year, when they were not expecting it, it was a surprise attack and it caught Israel off guard. And for a little while there, it was pretty dicey as far as Syria and Egypt taking territory and killing a lot of Israelis. But within 3 days, Israel turned the tables and were once again at the outskirts of Cairo and Damascus. So within 3 days, they had turned the tables and they kept the Sinai Peninsula and the Golan Heights, which is what Egypt and Syria were attacking to try to get back. Now you see, again, one more time in history, the Arab nations won it all. They attacked to try to wipe Israel off the map. Israel has won. And then the Arab nations say, but now we want it back. And that's exactly what they're doing right now with John Kerry and the peace talks, talking about territory that, you know what, any time else in history somebody wins a war, it's theirs. But not in this case. It's pretty interesting. Now then, you can also see why Israel is such on a heightened state of alert. Because 3 times in their past, Egypt and Syria have tried to take Israel's land back and wipe them off the map. So now then, with Egypt in total turmoil and Syria in total turmoil, you can understand why, out of past track record, Israel is just a little bit tense today, because they've seen it happen before. Nobody else seems to see that, but Israel knows. They know what the possibilities are. In 1978, Israel signed a peace treaty with Egypt, Part of that was to cede the Sinai Peninsula back to Egypt. Through that peace treaty, that they said that there would be no more Egyptian military artillery, tanks, heavy stuff in the Sinai Peninsula without Israel's approval. That was in 78. Well, we saw just a few weeks ago, with all the uprisings in Egypt, Egypt sent in their military into the Sinai to quell some militant rise-ups, people that were causing trouble, but they got approval from Israel to have tanks and artillery in the Sinai. That came out of the 78 peace treaty. So we still see today exactly what's been happening for all these years. We still see that. In 1995, after the two Oslo Accords, Oslo, Norway, one of them was in 93 and another one was in 95. These were talks with Israel and the Palestinian Authority about the land, about peace, all of these things that are still going on today. But out of those Oslo Accords, Israel agreed to start turning over territory authority to the Palestinian control. Now what happened there is that as Israel took all this land in 1967, their military controlled it. They've always been called the occupiers. They had their military in there for their own protection, just to keep things quiet in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. So what they did in the Oslo Accords is say, okay, beginning in 1995, we're going to start turning towns and areas in the West Bank over to Palestinian control. Okay, so Palestinians, you need to take control of it. You need to manage it. You need to provide security. Because if your people start coming into Israel and bombing us or rockets send in, then we're going to take action against you. Well, one of the first towns they started turning over was Jericho, and then Bethlehem was about 1995. It was interesting to see everywhere that Israel has turned control over to the Palestinians. For instance, in Bethlehem, before 1995, it was 80% Christian, about 20% Muslim. In the ensuing years, it is now 20% Christian or less, and 80% Muslim. Well, what happens, and it's happened all over the West Bank, everywhere where Islam rises, the other faiths dwindle. And it's all over the Arab world. You can look at all of the Arab countries. You can look at any Arab country. Saudi Arabia, you can't even have a Bible there. You can't, they have one church that's authorized by the government. Other countries, they won't allow Christians and Jews to worship at all. Most of the populations of the Jews and Christians are dwindling. Same way with Baghdad. After the United States left, guess what? The Christians and the Jews that were in Baghdad came under such persecution that they've been leaving also. Well, what happened in the West Bank as the Muslims began to take over, they started not only taking their own territory, but they also started taking a lot of the Jewish holy sites. Why? Because in the Quran, all of the Old Testament characters are noticed as in Islam as prophets. So the sites for Abraham, Jacob, Joseph that have been holy to Jews for 2,500 years or more, the Muslims began to take control of these holy sites because, well, we see this as the prophet, the Muslim prophet Abraham, or the Muslim prophet Joseph's sacred site. Now then, in a lot of those cases, just for the Jews to visit those sites, they have to have a military escort just to go and visit some of these sites. Islam teaches in the Quran that Islam will become dominant over all other religions. In every single case, they do not allow open and free worship by other religions. They don't do it. And this is the track record for the last, since 1995, just in the West Bank. So this is what you expect as Islam takes over these areas. The summer of 2000, Prime Minister of Israel at that time, Ehud Barak, exits the Lebanon border. That was that border zone that they took in the Six-Day War, a buffer zone. And he exits that again saying, okay, we're going to get out of this disputed land, but we will do it if you'll be peaceful about it. If you start firing rockets or whatever, we're going to have to come after you. Immediately, Hezbollah, the party of Allah, Hezbollah in Lebanon, started firing rockets into northern Israel. Israel retaliated. They had a ruckus even back then between Israel and Hezbollah. Land for peace, once again, does not work. Just does not work. Never has. July 2000, Camp David. Bill Clinton, Ehud Barak, and Yasser Arafat for the PLO met, and Arafat was offered, Ehud Barak offered Yasser Arafat 95% of the West Bank, East Jerusalem for a capital of the Palestinian nation, continued control of Temple Mount, and a study for the Palestinian refugee issue, the problem of refugee return. With that would come a Palestinian state recognized by the state of Israel. Arafat refused. He walked out on the talks. Now you got to ask one more time, why would they turn down such an incredible offer? And again, the answer is they don't want part of this territory. They want all of this territory. That is the driving force between the Palestinians, all of the Arab nations, the Hamas, Hezbollah, all of these groups. Their intent is that this land will not have any Jewish people in it. It needs to be completely taken over by the Palestinians and given to the religion of Islam. That's their intent. Why else would Yasser Arafat have turned down such an amazing, incredible offer on a world stage? So, that's the intent. September of 2000, Ariel Sharon, who was a general in the Israeli Defense Forces during the War of Independence and again in the Six-Day War, he was a famous general. He also had a bit of a bad reputation with the Arabs. They accused him of some war atrocities in some of the Arab towns during the conflicts, and so he did not have a good reputation with them at all. He asked permission to go up on Temple Mount with an entourage, and he was given permission by the Muslim authorities. However, in September 2000, when he went up on Temple Mount, there immediately started a riot by the Muslims up there, and it turned into a battle up on Temple Mount. There were shots fired by the Israeli authorities, the security people, and it got to be a mess, and that began what we now know as the Third Intifada, or uprising. What we got to see during that time was a huge increase in suicide bombings in the state of Israel by the Palestinians coming in from the West Bank. There was a lot of killing going on for several years there on both sides. From that point on, non-Muslims were barred from Temple Mount at all. We were there in 2001, January of 2001, and we were not allowed up on Temple Mount as Christians. You just don't go up there. And that wasn't lifted until like 2004 or 5, something like that. So this uprising that started was all because Ariel Sharon supposedly went on Temple Mount. However, he had approval from the authorities to do that. So as time went on, we kind of discovered that that was all planned by Yasser Arafat in order to have a reason after the Camp David Accords to begin another battle with the Israelis. Okay? So that was all just kind of in there together. Now then, as we know, September 11, 2001, the United States was attacked. And one of the reasons that Al-Qaeda from Osama bin Laden, he gave one of the reasons for that attack was the United States' support of Israel. in a lot of his letters and interviews that he did, talks, everything like that, it was in there somewhere that because of our support of the nation of Israel, this is another reason that we attacked you. Again, we are the great Satan. Israel is the little Satan. We are still referred to as that name by several of the different Muslim groups. So that's kind of where it began. In 2002, Israel began building what they call a barrier wall. It is about a 20, 25-foot concrete wall around the outline of the West Bank. And, of course, it met with enormous world resistance and response because it became known as the apartheid wall, the segregation wall, the barrier between the Arabs and the Jews. It is a point of contention. Number one, they argue with the exact path of this wall because they're saying Israel is de facto outlining their borders with this concrete barrier. Israel was saying, all we're doing is trying to keep the suicide bombers out. Well, it's real interesting that after 2002, up until 2002, there were dozens of suicide attacks in Israel. After 2002 and the wall began, all of a sudden the attacks started dwindling, and the more of this wall that has come up, there haven't been any suicide attacks in Israel in the last several years. Israel was right. They were keeping out attackers. So what they say is that we're doing this just for our own security because the Palestinian Authority is not taking control of the situation. We're going to keep them out. Also, I thought it was interesting that in April of 2003 or March in 2003 when the United States attacked Iraq, also I think that had a little bit to do with the decline in suicide attacks in Israel. Because Saddam Hussein was giving $25,000 to every martyr's family in Israel for the Palestinians who attacked Israel and died in that attack, he gave $25,000 to that family. Guess what? Whenever Saddam Hussein disappeared, so did that money. It dried up. So now you got to wonder, did they want the 72 versions or the $25,000? So, there's no more money coming in, and so I think between the barrier wall and the fall of Saddam Hussein, that put an end to the suicide attacks in Israel. I really do think that had a lot to do with it. Okay, in November 2004, Yasser Arafat died. They are currently trying to exhume his body. I haven't seen here in just the last few weeks if they've decided to do that. The suspicion was all along that Arafat died because he was poisoned by the Israelis somehow. They couldn't prove it or anything like that, but now they're wanting to exhume his body to see if they can find traces of the poison. But his wife, who is still alive, hasn't authorized that yet, so that was interesting. In August of 2005, Ariel Sharon becomes he's already prime minister, and in 2005, he decides to exit the Gaza Strip, meaning he is taking all the Jewish people out of Gaza Strip and dismantling their settlements. Now, at this point in time, there's about 9,000 Jews in Gaza Strip. They have built farming communities, greenhouses, a lot of things, in just beautiful places that are very productive in the Gaza Strip. Ariel Sharon says, we will take all the Jews out of the Gaza Strip for the sake of peace. Once again, land for peace. At that point, the United States, Jews from the United States, they donated $14 million to purchase all of those greenhouses from the exiting Jews. So the Jews of Israel received $14 million from the Jews in the United States. The Jews in the United States then donated all those greenhouses and equipment and everything to the Palestinians of Gaza Strip. Well, now, you would think that, well, what a wonderful gesture for the sake of peace. And what an incredible thing that the Palestinians could just move into these areas and continue to be productive and to sell goods and to grow. That's not what happened. They immediately started looting all the facilities. They tore down all the greenhouses, stole the copper, stole all of the stuff, and totally demolished everything that was left. Not very appreciative, was it? But that's exactly what happened. And remember, Ariel Sharon told them, again, now then, this land is yours. We're not having any presence whatsoever in the Gaza Strip. It's all yours. But if you start firing missiles at us, we're coming after you. Almost immediately, that's exactly what happened. They give them the land, they evacuate all the Jews, and Hamas begins to fire missiles into Israel. And so ever since 2005, they've been kind of on again, off again with missile attacks and Israel going in and bombing different sites. It's been contentious. Land for peace doesn't work. Still doesn't. January 2006, Ariel Sharon has a stroke. He is still in a coma. He is still there. And I tell you, there was a lot of people in the Israeli papers and in the Israeli news that were saying, you divide God's land and that's what happens. I mean, we can't say that for certain, but I guarantee you there was a lot of Israelis, religious folks that were saying, that's what happens when you divide God's land. February of 2006, we had a democratic election in the Palestinian territories. You remember that? Oh! Kind of like Egypt. We had a democratic election. Oh! We didn't want them to win. This is the same thing. Hamas, the militant group Hamas, won the election in the Palestinian territories. Well, that's not the way we wanted the democratic election to turn out, but that's the way it turned out. Hamas won. Immediately, they began a battle within the Palestinian Authority, Liberation Organization, with the Fatah movement. Yasser Arafat was the head of Fatah. And Hamas and Fatah wanted to control all of this. Fatah wasn't ready to give it up. Hamas said, hey, we won the election. We want Gaza Strip and the West Bank. So after some internal violence and battles and killing and all kinds of stuff, they finally settled on Hamas will take the Gaza Strip and Fatah is in charge of the West Bank. And that's the way it still is today. Now then, and I've said this before, now then, if you're talking about a peace treaty between the Israelis and the Palestinians, Mr. Kerry, who are you going to talk to? The United States has Hamas listed as a terrorist organization. But they did win that democratic election, just like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Sometimes democracy doesn't work out like we want. Sometimes you get what you vote for. So, that's just the way democracy works. So, again, you actually have two groups you're going to have to do something with. The Gaza Strip is like a third country. They're going to have to be involved somehow. How it's all going to work out, don't know yet. But that's part of the problem, is the Palestinians aren't even getting along. How do you negotiate with two fighting factions of the Palestinians? And what do you do with this territory? What do you do with all of this? So it's a very contentious issue. It's a messy thing. It is just messy. So that's what is still in effect, is Hamas in the Gaza Strip, the Fatah in the West Bank. July of 2006, another instance where Hezbollah started firing rockets into Israel, and for several months the Israelis were into heavy battle in southern Lebanon, sometimes all the way up to Beirut. It was a really mess during that time. So now it's finally calmed back down for a little while. With all the uprising in Syria, Israel is really on the alert for Hezbollah attacks. Hezbollah and Syria and Iran are all in bed together. So one of the suppositions is that Hezbollah will start something with Israel just to take all the focus off of Bashar Assad. And I wouldn't doubt it a bit. Wouldn't doubt it a bit. It's interesting. We got all of our own problems here, and if we can just attack the Jews, that'll get the focus off of us. That's exactly what they do. June of 2007, Ehud Olmert, the prime minister at that time, offers the Golan Heights back to Syria. It was kind of a surprise deal. Even the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, there's a lot of people going, wait, you know, he didn't ask us. Are you're doing this without our permission? I mean, it was a really big deal. But he did it with a condition that he said, we will give you the Golan Heights back, Syria, for peace, if you will renounce your ties with Iran. That didn't work. Syria refused, of course, because they're not about to break that tie with Iran. But it was offered. You see all of this history. Time after time after time, Israel offers. They make gestures. They actually cede land. They try and they try and they try. Every single time, they get bit. Every single time. Then we saw in November, December of last year, over 1,000 rockets fired from the Gaza Strip into southern Israel. Some of them even reached the edge of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, which those were new longer-range rockets that kind of surprised everybody. So there's a lot of danger still from Hamas in the Gaza Strip in the south and Hezbollah in Lebanon in the north. There's just constant tension around these areas. In November of 2012, last November, the United Nations voted to recognize Palestine as a non-member observer state. The significance of this is a non-member observer state is the same status as the Vatican. Okay? The interesting thing about this is here's a country that has no borders, has no constitution, and they are not a sovereign nation. And yet, they were given membership as a non-member observer state. Just blows me away. How do you do that? How do you do that? Just a few weeks ago, and I showed you this before, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas laid out his vision on Monday for the final status of Israeli-Palestinian relations ahead of peace talks due to resume in Washington for the first time in nearly 3 years. Okay, so this was just in July. In a final resolution, and I showed you this before, the original newsletters that came out said in a final solution, which I thought were horrible words because those are the terms that Hitler used to get rid of all the Jews. But then the next day they came out with, in the final resolution, we would not see the presence of a single Israeli, civilian, or soldier on our lands. Okay, now then, here is a United Nations recognized state that says up front, any peace talks that come to fruition will not involve Jews living in our territory. Now then, you remember I just told you that they call this big concrete wall an apartheid wall. Now exactly who is it that's the apartheid member of this party? Remember, the Israelis have allowed the Arabs to become citizens of Israel. Arabs and Muslims even serve in the Israeli parliament. But Mahmoud Abbas is not willing to even have a Jewish person live in the new state of Palestine. Who's apartheid here? Who is it? See, all of this just keeps coming up. All right. I want to show you one more thing just in the next few minutes. Are there any questions? I mean, we've kind of bounced through history and we're kind of up to date here. Any questions that you run into? I want to go back just a few years and show you something really significant that happened. So, yes, ma'am?
I've seen just history. I've been on the thing that when Muslims move into a state or territory or whatever, they end up infiltrating into the government and everything. Is that going to happen here?
She was saying it seems like wherever Muslims begin growth in different countries that they wind up taking over. You just need to witness France and Great Britain to see what's happened there in the last 20 years. I think that that's indicative of what's going to happen here in the next 20 years also. That's, you know, somebody mentioned, I can't remember who it was, just the natural growth rate of the Muslim families is higher than the countries they're moving into. They're certainly higher than the United States. So just given a few years at a certain growth rate, that's what happens. But then you also see things already happening in the United States with three years already, maybe two, Oklahoma voted 70% majority to outlaw any law except United States law in Oklahoma. Their intent was to keep out any influence of Sharia law, Muslim Sharia law. The day after that, there was a lawsuit filed by a Muslim organization, and it's still up, hung up in courts. Okay, so you can see the little attacks going on already. There are already places up in Michigan and in Florida that there are communities of Muslims where they are considered no-go zones for non-Muslims. You just don't go in there because they are starting to use their own Sharia law in small communities in these larger cities. Dearborn, Michigan, places in Florida. So you see the inroads being made, and I think it's probably going to get worse. All right, the last thing I want to show you right quick is, remember I talked about the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was a Jewish legal assembly that we see active in the time of Christ. It was before that, but active in the time of Christ. In John 11, after Jesus resurrects Lazarus, the Pharisees call a meeting of the Sanhedrin. Like I say, this is the Jewish legal assembly. It's made up of 70 rabbis and the high priest at that time. So 71 individuals make up the Sanhedrin. They rule according to Jewish law on different matters. So when Jesus was here and he was called before the Sanhedrin, it was to decide on, did Jesus do something illegal according to Moses' law? All right? Mark 15:1 shows the Sanhedrin's legal decision concerning Jesus and his conviction, arrest and conviction and sentence, okay? Then in Acts, we see Peter, John, Paul, Stephen, all of these people appearing before the Sanhedrin. So the Sanhedrin was very much alive and in effect in Jesus' time and the apostles' time. Now then, after 70 AD, after the destruction of the temple, and the Jews began to disperse. So the worldwide dispersion of the Jewish people that we saw that began in 70 AD. As time went on, there were fewer and fewer Jews in Israel for this 71-member assembly to legislate over. Also, their meeting place was destroyed because their meeting place was the temple. So as more and more Jews left, they finally moved to Tiberias up on the Sea of Galilee. And then in 425, this Jewish legal assembly, the Sanhedrin, disbanded because there weren't enough Jews left in Israel to have any legal decision over. There's always been Jews in Israel, but it just didn't make sense to continue the Sanhedrin. All right? Now then, roll that ahead 2,500 years. October of 2004, the Sanhedrin reforms. We now have a Sanhedrin again. You read about it in the Bible, and now you know that the Sanhedrin has reformed after 1,600 years. Their reasons for this was just fascinating. They said, by Jewish law, we must have a Sanhedrin because now we have constituents again to decide legal matters over. So by Jewish law, we need a Sanhedrin. Also, since we have had such an enormous influx of Jews, that has given us our constituent base. So as we see the gathering of the Jews during the 20th century and even into today, now the Sanhedrin says it makes sense for us to form again. And one of their other reasons was, and besides, God tells us in Malachi that Elijah has to appear before the Sanhedrin to announce the coming of the Messiah. So we need a Sanhedrin again. Now, like I've said before, it is absolutely incredible to see all of the different viewpoints of the end times and the coming of the Messiah from the Jewish side, from the Muslim side, from the Christian side, to see all of these things happening. And all you're doing is looking and saying, that's what God said in the Old Testament. And the Jews are saying, we need to continue to do this because the Messiah is coming. We're looking at it from our viewpoint going, you ain't seen nothing yet because Jesus is coming back again. The Messiah has been here and he's coming back. The Muslims are going, well, when the Muslim Messiah comes, Jesus is coming with him, and it's all tied together. It's fascinating to see this. January 2005, the Sanhedrin put out a search for any Jewish boy, man, who could reasonably show his line of descent from King David. And they have qualified members that do that. Why would they want to do that? Because whenever the Messiah comes, Israel needs to have another king from the lineage of David ready to go. They have a pool of qualified descendants of David ready to go. They have a king of Israel, a possible king of Israel ready to go. They also know who all of the priests are that will serve at the new temple. They know who the qualified priests are today to serve at the new temple. March 2005, they came out with an official statement saying disengagement of any territory of this land is against Jewish law. And their reading was, God said this land is ours, therefore to disengage from it, to give any of it up, is against Jewish law. Now then, of course, the Israeli Knesset, the political end of it, they're just a bunch of religious kooks. But you see what's going on, according to Scripture, within the Jewish society. February 2007, they actually were gathering legal animals for sacrifice for Passover. The Sanhedrin is very much involved with all of the different aspects of Jewish life. One of the first things they did was to contract with an architect to design a tilt-up construction temple. So they are ready for the third temple to be built. Tilt-up construction is a bunch of concrete panels built to size. It's just like when you see a Walmart. It's not there one day and the next day, hey, we got a Walmart. All they do is tilt up these prefab concrete panels, tie them together in place, and they've got a building. They have the third temple already built in that manner, ready to go. The Sanhedrin is very much in touch. There's a group called the Temple Mount Faithful and the Temple Institute that's also involved with having everything ready to go whenever the third temple is built. So it's very much alive. It's going on today, and that's why the contention over Temple Mount is so focused. It's so powerful to see the Muslim fights, the Muslim influence and the Jewish influence all over that little piece of territory. Because the Jews say, that's where our third temple belongs. The Muslims say, you're not going to get it. This is where the Dome of the Rock stands. That's why it's so powerful. Yes, sir?
What year was it that there were Jewish priests that invaded the Dome?
Let's see. I can't remember what year it was. That's happened.
They were part of the Sanhedrin that was trying to take over and build.
Yep. There have been several times where the Jews have gone up. Every year at the same time, the Temple Mount Faithful take the cornerstone of the temple in a ceremony to, they want to lay the cornerstone of the temple. Of course, the Israeli authorities tell them, get away, don't stir up anything. But every year they try to do that. There's been attempts by the Jews up on Temple Mount to take some of that back. There's been Christian attempts to start something up on Temple Mount to get all of that started. So there's a lot of attention up there. So, okay, any other questions? Next week I'm going to finish up with the rest. There's a little bit more of the end gathering that you need to see that I think we're seeing today. So a little bit of the end gathering, and then we'll talk a little bit about the meaning of this third temple and what's going on with that right now. So, okay? Anything else? Let's have a prayer. Almighty God, we thank you for your word, and we see throughout thousands of years how you have worked with the nation of Israel and the Jewish people. And we know from your scripture that you continue to work with them today. God, we thank you for your faithfulness with them. And we know that through the blood of your Son, that how much more faithful are you with us. From that sacrifice that assures us of eternal life with you, assures us that you're a God who keeps his promises throughout history, throughout time. You keep your promises everlasting. We thank you that you are God. In Jesus' name, amen.